Hello and welcome to Undivided. Happy Friday to all of you. Thank you for being here. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you have not taken the leap to support the show already, remember, we're doing this as an alternative to the mainstream media, particularly in Seattle, that is so one-sided, and we need your support to be able to continue the show, to grow this mission. So you can do that in two ways, patreon.com/undivided, that's patreon.com/undivided, or you can become a contributor on my locals community, brandicruz.locals.com. It's just $5 a month, and we have a goal this month at 250 new subscribers, so you can be one of them. It'll be great. All right, coming up on the show today, I'm going to introduce you to the host of the Rational in Portland podcast. She's a lifelong Democrat who grew tired of the way that progressives in her city were lying about and failing to solve issues like homelessness and substance abuse. I always think it's great to bring other common sense voices from other places in the fold who you might not have heard of or listened to before. So we're looking forward to having Kristen on the show. Also coming up, you know, we do a Florida Report every Friday, and when we talk about environmental issues, I think usually people look at blue states and what states like Washington are doing, but actually, Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida has been praised for his environmental work, and he has just announced his new four-year plan while he is the governor, if that lasts, and he doesn't run for president, so Miranda's going to discuss that a little bit. I'm also going to hear your thoughts on the proposal that the voter guides sent out to all of you are actually fact-checked. Because apparently we've learned there's a lot of political candidates who feel like they can tell outright outrageous lies about their backgrounds, their education, their military service, and they're getting away with it. So what are you supposed to do? You guys were really split on whether the government should truly be fact-checking political candidates and whether the government would be able to do that fairly. So I'll read your comments coming up at the end. I have a rant to start the podcast with today. I told you one of my priorities, not just going into 2023, but also really since early on in the pandemic, was encouraging lawmakers from both sides of the aisle to come together and pass emergency power reform. You know, for states across the country, it was not unusual to have governors declare a state of emergency around COVID-19. And I think, you know, at the very beginning of the pandemic, we were all like, yeah, I mean, this is obviously an emergency, unlike what many of us have been through in our lives. So state of emergency makes sense. But Washington state is one of only a few states that didn't have any checks and balances on that emergency power. So in other states, you had legislatures that had the ability to weigh in, had the ability to end a state of emergency if their executive was abusing that emergency power privilege. But Washington, we didn't. So all the mandates the governor put down, all the wild things that the governor did, you know, lawmakers had no say in it. They really didn't. And I thought to myself, you know, the first 6 months, even I would go the first year, I suppose, I was sort of like, okay, whatever. But as it dragged on, I was baffled. Even when I was in mainstream media and I was pointing this out on the air, I was baffled by the fact that lawmakers wouldn't be pushing to have some say on behalf of their constituents. You know, after all, I think the government is most effective when the power is closest to the people. And the individual state lawmakers that we send to the State House in Olympia are far closer to the people of their districts than the governor is. And so I just thought, why do you even want those jobs if you don't want to have a say in something as enormous as the pandemic response? It was wild to me. So anyway, starting in 2021, Republicans really started pushing for this idea of emergency power reform. Like, hey, we need to do what other states have done and put some checks and balances, not just for this governor, but for a future governor. If you've got somebody in there who is wildly abusing their emergency power authority to be able to force things on people, suspend laws, put down mandates, we have to have a way to do something about that. Didn't happen in 2021. They tried again in 2022, didn't happen in 2022. And then this year there was another effort and it was bipartisan. In fact, I had Democratic State Senator Mark Mullett and Republican State Senator Linda Wilson on the show not too long ago, you'll recall, because they dropped a really reasonable bipartisan bill that would have put some reasonable checks and balances on a governor's emergency power. And, you know, it would have done so in a way that would have always required bipartisan agreement to be able to end a state of emergency. Here's a little clip of our interview we did with them when they dropped this bill for consideration.
I think I've signed on with Senator Wilson the past few sessions because I say to my colleagues, you have to look at this of what's the right form of government, not who currently has the governor's seat, but pretend it was the opposite party who had the governor's seat. What set of rules would you want in place? And I think if everyone's being intellectually honest with themselves, they would all support this bill because if the shoe was on the other foot, we would want this bill in place. And so I don't see how my message to my colleagues is we should respect how our Republican folks would want the same. And we would want the same. And this bill is actually the right public policy for the state of Washington. The governor can enact an emergency. It can't go on forever without involving the legislature at a much greater extent.
Well, we're finding out this week that that bill has been deemed dead on arrival by the majority party. Democrats in Olympia are not interested in pursuing that. And I think if it doesn't happen this session, which it's not going to, it's never going to happen. And that is so disappointing to me. It's really frustrating to me because to me, it's all about politics. It's not about good policy. And in fact, I was filling in yesterday on Cairo News Radio in the slot that was held by my friend Dory Monson. I'm just filling in for a couple weeks. And Mark Mullett hopped on the show, again, a Democrat. And I got to say, it was the most honest I've ever heard him. And he really thinks that people are scared. Democrats in his party are scared of supporting this legislation because they're worried about retribution from the governor.
It's been a frustrating process, let's leave it at that, where I think the governor has put a lot of political capital into trying to keep any bills that would limit his emergency power authority from gaining traction during the legislative session, not just this one, the same in the previous sessions as well. And it appears we've had a similar dynamic where I think there's been pressure put on, you know, to not even hear the bill. So it's frustrating.
Tell me more about that. So you're obviously a Democrat. What are you hearing something from your Democratic colleagues about how they're like, hey, this is too hot to touch or what?
I think there was a much weaker version of the bill last year during the 22 session. And the governor clearly signaled his intention would be to veto that bill if it were to get to the finish line. So even though it passed the Senate, it never did pass the House. And so I think people on the Senate side are saying, well, if a weaker version couldn't get to the finish line last year, is it worth having, you know, even hearing the bill this time around? And my counter argument to that is we need to have this public policy discussion, and Democrats, my colleagues, I say, they have to put the shoe on the other foot and pretend there is a Republican in the governor's mansion. And would they be comfortable if these same things were happening? And I know they would not be. And so I just keep reminding my colleagues to imagine yourself on the other side of the fence. And would you think differently? I know they would. Mm-hmm. But that being said, it's still been difficult to have the public policy discussion down here.
You talked about kind of the politics behind the scenes. You know, you have gone against the governor on certain things, and there have been consequences for that. you can talk about some of those if you'd like. I mean, for the first time in his 10 years as governor, he endorsed a primary opponent to you, a progressive. He was out there sine waving on her behalf during the pandemic.
I think that was one of the first times in the last century a governor's come out against a member of their own party. So it's highly different.
Yeah. I mean, do you anticipate any continued retribution this session because of your support of emergency power reform and your opposition to other issues that are important to the governor?
To be honest, I do. I think that's been kind of frustrating as well. I had I chaired last year the Business Financial Service Committee, and we had a bill come out of that process, 49-0. It passed the Senate, it passed the House, and the governor vetoed it. And so it was really surprising. I think some of those things happen for kind of petty, personal, vindictive reasons, and that's always disappointing because when you're making public policy, you shouldn't be letting things get emotional and personal like that. But I do think it's also sending a message to my colleagues like, hey, you're at risk of having bills vetoed if you go down the same path.
And, you know, I give so much freaking credit to Senator Mark Mullett for doing what we always preach on this show, which is looking at things independently, thinking critically outside the party affiliation. Does this make sense? Is it good policy or is it not good policy? And as he points out, I mean, that is the most self-aware that you will hear from a politician. As he points out, you better believe that Democrats would be calling for it if there were a Republican in the governor's office. I mean, I don't think a Republican would have had a state of emergency for 975 days. But if the shoe was on the other foot, you bet your ass that Democrats would be on board with it. And the fact that, and again, this is a Democrat saying this, that he's saying, look, Democrats are simply scared of retribution from a governor of their own political party. How sad is that? They're not willing to stick up and do the right thing for their constituents who sent them to the state house because they're scared of Governor Inslee, who's a lame duck governor. He's not running again. Who got 1% in his, did he even get 1% in his bid for the presidency? He's going to be out in a year. And you're that scared of retribution from the governor that you won't do the right thing. It says so much about those Democrats and who they are as politicians. They're prioritizing Governor Inslee over you. They're prioritizing the wants and needs and desires of Governor Inslee over you. Are you okay with that? That's the question. Are you okay with that? Because it's blatant. You're hearing that again. It's not from me. It's from a Democrat. That is what's happening. And if they're not brave enough to stand up to a governor of their own political party, what makes you think that they're brave enough to do what needs to be done to turn this state around on public safety, on homelessness, on crime, on mental health? That's a serious question for if there's any Democrats or progressives listening. Does that bother you? Does that bother you? You know, this obsession with political party and doing things for your political party and not the people is destroying the country. It's why I just pray to God that there is some sort of movement toward either a third party or viable independent candidates. You know, we've seen some Democrats leave their party to become independents. We've seen some Republicans do the same. And I'm hopeful that that will continue, that people who truly want to be public servants, who truly want to govern, are going to say, you know what? I can't serve my party and the people at the same time. I was nervous today. I posted on social media a before and after picture of my weight loss. And there's this picture in particular from October. And I hadn't used it yet because by far it is just, it is a horrible, horrible depiction of how much weight I gained. And I was so embarrassed to even post it. But I'm like, you guys are nice. You're supportive. And it just shows how much weight I was able to lose in such a short period of time on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan. As I've been talking about, I've lost now more than 25 pounds. I gained 42 during the pandemic, so I still have a few more pounds to go. But I've been sharing this, and I added Eastside Weight Loss Clinic as a sponsor only after I went through the program for 2 months, because I'm like, you know, well, I was just doing the program for myself. I wasn't necessarily doing it to add them as a sponsor, but I was like, okay, if this works, like we're gonna throw them on the podcast. And I've heard from so many of you who are like, wow, that's impressive results, and who want to get healthier, want to get in shape. So don't wait. I mean, I had heard Eastside Weight Loss Clinic ads on the radio on my drive in for like 3 months before I was like, you know what? I'm going to try it. I'm going to do this for myself. I have a wedding coming up. I don't want to feel like this anymore. I've gained so much weight. I'm sick of looking at pictures where I look awful. And man, 2 months later, I'm so glad I did. So give Dr. Coogan a call or schedule a free online consultation with Eastside Weight Loss Clinic where they can talk you through things. You can decide, is this program right for me? So call them at 425-354-3020. 425-354-3020, or visit eastsideweightlossclinic.com, eastsideweightlossclinic.com, and tell them you heard about them on the Undivided podcast. It's really important, I think, to talk about, as we talk about issues in Washington state around homelessness, around crime, you know, we're not alone. There are other states who are dealing with these same things, and they just happen to be right below us, Oregon, California. very similar ideologies, very similar political makeups, and very similar problems. That is not a freaking coincidence. I got a chance recently to connect with a woman named Kristen Olson. She hosts a podcast in Portland called the Rational in Portland podcast. You know us, we love rational people, reason, common sense. And so I wanted to talk to her about the movement and the momentum that she's been building with her podcast in Portland. So she was nice enough to join us for Fridays with Friends. Kristen, welcome to the Undivided Podcast.
Hi, Brandy. Thanks so much for having me on.
So give folks a little introduction background on yourself.
Sure. So I'm a trial lawyer in Portland, Oregon. I'm a Portland native. I went to the University of Oregon for law school. And around 2020 or so, we were the penultimate state to open in the United States to open up our schools to kids. So I was at home with my two young children, as a lot of working moms were. And a lot of people in my city were terrified of COVID, probably like people in your city, for all sorts of reasons. But I was feeling isolated, and I wasn't really able to have the kinds of conversations about issues like, why are our schools still closed when all these others are open and teachers and kids don't seem to be dropping dead? And why are we spending all these millions on homelessness and yet we can't navigate our sidewalks because they're filled with tents and people splayed out in the gutters? And so I just started talking to people. I talked to government officials. I talked to community leaders, and they were willing to have those conversations with me. They were willing to have them as long as I wanted to, for hours even. And I just got tired of repeating what I heard to other officials and community leaders and people who maybe thought that they disagreed with me on some of those points. But then once they learned about what was going on, like once they learned about things like, you know, other schools seem to be functioning okay across the country, or things like, hey, there are other cities that have homeless issues too, that don't seem to be experiencing the abject crises that places like Seattle, your city, Portland, San Francisco are experiencing. They were interested. And so I just started pressing record, and I was initially concerned, you know, I thought, well, maybe people won't be as candid with me, but they're fine with it. I mean, everybody wants to talk, and they're incredibly generous with their time. I sat with the head of the Portland Police Union for like 4 hours. I mean, so the point of the podcast is called Rational in Portland, is to provide a space for things like long form conversations about complicated issues, which nobody has the time or money to engage in anymore, of course. And Brandy, you know, from your show, we have this media vacuum. Especially in these cities.
Yeah.
And investigative journalism is costly. And these investigative journalists are dropping like flies. You know, I had Jonathan Cho on, and I think you know him pretty well. And yeah. I'm sure he's been on your show. He's great. And he said, you know, he used to do investigative journalism. And he said, there's just no space for that anymore. And these former investigative journalists are going on to other careers. So I'm lucky enough that I have some resources and I have some time and to spend on this. And I'm committed to Portland. I'm committed to living here. And I can't, it's like a priest I'm called. I can't do it unless I can't live here unless I engage in these kinds of conversations and try to come up with solutions, because people just don't know what's going on around here. I mean, we have a lack of civic education, just like in your city.
What is the ideology you came into this with? Because I think I read you're
progressive.
Progressive.
I'm sorry, what did you read?
Well, no, that you were a Democrat.
I am. Yeah, lifelong. I'm still a Democrat. And you know, you'd be stupid not to be, frankly, if you lived in this city, because you're not gonna get a say. We have closed primaries. So in the state of Oregon, you're really not gonna have a say, especially in the city of Portland, most city positions, people don't understand this, but all the city positions are nonpartisan, but the governor is obviously partisan and very important. A lot of people, because of our closed primaries, just ignore the primary election, unfortunately. They feel like they don't have a say. So I'm still a Democrat. I still consider myself part of that party, but I don't consider myself on the extreme side of that party in the way that I did when I started the podcast. I mean, when I started this podcast, Brandy, I had never had a substantive conversation with anybody who voted for Donald Trump.
And that's changed.
Yeah, I mean now, yes. So now I'm labeled by progressives who I considered my people as like a gateway to the alt-right because I'm willing to talk to people who voted for Donald Trump.
We were at the same event. It was the last weekend. Yeah, just last weekend. We didn't get a chance to meet, but somebody connected us via text afterwards. And we were in this room full of people that I've never been in a room full of people who were so willing to be honest about the problems that cities like Seattle and Portland face when it comes to drug abuse and homelessness. People who are willing to say, look, this is a drug crisis. We have to make sure that we're practicing real empathy, not apathy. Do you feel and have you felt any sort of shift in Portland among people who are willing to be a little more honest about the issues on the, that are unfolding on the streets?
So yeah, you're right. And I was so thrilled that you were in attendance there. And I was thrilled with that event too. That event was a gala to celebrate a retreat that I was invited to by Andrea Suarez of We Heart Seattle and Michael Schellenberger, who ran for governor of California. And there's about 40 of us who were invited to this retreat. I was the only one there from Portland. It's a coalition to come up with solutions to drugs and the homelessness crisis. And as you said, those of us who were in that room that night, we may be from different political spheres. We may be on, I mean, I met a lot of friends from this coalition at this retreat who are feel very differently from me politically, but we are aligned, as you said, in the idea that this homelessness crisis is really an issue about drugs and mental illness. It's not an issue of housing.
Yeah.
These aren't people splayed out on the streets are not people one paycheck away from living in a beautiful townhome in a suburb. I mean, if anybody's ever tried to sleep on a sidewalk, they would know that these are not sober or functional people and on any level that really need help, need to get off the streets. We were all aligned on that. I am not seeing a huge shift in the conversation on those issues. And one of the reasons is because I think in Portland and in Oregon, which is Portland's an incredibly progressive city. It might be the most progressive city. I mean, unlike Seattle, I just can't imagine us having a city attorney who's a conservative. I can't imagine us having a moderate mayor. I mean, our mayor is considered moderate in our city,
Yeah.
but our mayor is not considered moderate in the United States. So we are dealing with a whole different animal here politically. And one of the issues that we're also dealing with is, and I think this is true throughout the United States. I think the reason we didn't see a red wave that a lot of people saw coming, with the school closures and the this these drug and mental illness crises that are happening in these progressive cities. The reason we didn't see a red wave, I think, is because of the Dobbs decision.
Yeah.
And because a lot of these progressive politicians, like Tina Kotek, who's now our governor, ran on this idea that your access to abortion is in danger. And that, of course, in Oregon, that's not true. We've got a very progressive legislature. It's in the hands of the legislature. Christine Drazin came bizarrely close for Oregon to winning, I think, because there are people who understand those issues. But we became clouded by this Dobbs decision, and we fell for this trick that our governor, now Governor Tina Kotek, was engaging in, telling us that our abortion rights were under attack.
Yeah.
And we voted for her. And people in Oregon polled on homelessness and crime; those were very high. But I think ultimately, when it came down to the ballot, their biggest concern turned out, I think, to be abortion.
Yeah, and
And that's unfortunate.
we saw the polling here too ahead of our legislative session that you've got crime, the economy, homelessness, very high on the list of what folks wanted lawmakers to prioritize, yet they voted for people who would maintain kind of the status quo and the policies that, got them upset about those issues in the first place. When it comes to your new governor, Governor Kotek, she, one of her first acts was declare a state of emergency on homelessness. But she, like our governor,
believes it's a housing crisis. Do you believe it's a housing crisis? And how confident are you that the plan COTEC has laid out is going to make a difference?
Well, as you know, Brandy, because I'm part of Michael Schellenberger's coalition on homelessness and addiction, and I was selected to attend this retreat, and you know, we had this celebration that we were all at together. I don't believe it's a housing issue. We were all aligned in that room that it's not a housing issue. Now, one thing that I've learned from doing the podcast is people will talk to me. Yes, they'll talk to me on the record, but a lot of people also talk to me off the record. And one thing that I've learned is that Tina Kotek is funded by developers. Now, maybe that's part of her incentive to just say this is a housing issue and we need to build, build, build. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe she's just ideologically aligned in that way. That might be true as well. She told me when I met her that housing is a public good. So she may really believe that. But of course, the developers are all getting behind her and funding her to the nth degree because you know, housing is just inordinately expensive to build here in Portland, probably like it is in Seattle, yeah. Because we engage in this rigmarole of, you know, environmental regulations and pay regulations, which are great. You know, we should pay people for hard work. We should pay them well, but it's just, we've made it inordinately expensive to build, you know, this 300 square foot apartment. These things end up costing us like $300, $400 per square foot. It's ridiculous. This is our affordable housing plan. So it's not a housing crisis. We're not going to build our way out of it, especially not in one of the most expensive real estate markets in America. That's just not going to happen. We can construct shelter almost instantaneously. In fact, in Portland, you probably noticed this in Seattle. In Portland, we had an ice storm. We immediately opened spaces for shelter. Mm-hmm. We declared that we had enough places, warming shelters, we called them. We had enough places for people to go. Yeah. But when there's not an ice storm, the argument is we just don't have capacity, or the argument is, well, they don't want to go to shelter, or the argument is the shelter is not good enough. And there's this ideological idea that we need to put them all in a house. And if we put them in a house, then we can get them stable enough to want treatment. But our issue, of course, that's different than Seattle is Oregon passed Measure 110, which decriminalized all drugs. And we fell for this guinea pig experiment brought to us by the Drug Policy Alliance that was, quote unquote, based on the Portugal model. But it's not. What happened is we did not build treatment centers prior to decriminalizing all drugs, including fentanyl, which is poisoning all of us. It's overtaken in America. It's overtaken the rate of death for adults. It's number one. It's more than car accidents. So overdose. I mean, it's just incredible. Yeah. But it's really epicenter. I saw it in Seattle. I see it in Portland. And now that we've decriminalized all drugs, including hard drugs, before we opened our treatment centers, we put the cart before the horse. We're not engaging in the Portugal model. In Portugal, as we learned during this retreat, Michael Schellenberger has visited Portugal. Many of the people that belong to our coalition not only visited Portugal, they've talked to the doctor who created this decriminalization model there. And they started by building treatment centers. They're treatment-based. In Oregon, as in Seattle, we are harm reduction-based. And the Measure 110 has no interest in drug treatment or detox. Now, the measure says treatment, but what it actually meant was, you know, safe smoking kits and not needle exchanges, needle handouts, because as we know from Portland and Seattle, there's not a lot of needles being exchanged. If there were, there wouldn't be all over the streets.
Yeah. I've never been a progressive. I think I was a Democrat at one point when I was much younger. But so tap into, Kristen, that progressive part of your brain. And try to, how do you believe we can shift the narrative on this in places like Portland and California and Washington State? How do you believe we can get progressive Democrats to start thinking about this not as a housing crisis, but as a drug crisis?
That's a great question. You know, what's funny, Brandy, is we are shifting the narrative. So when I started the podcast, I was terrified to use my name. I didn't want anybody to know who I was, yeah. Because I was scared I would lose my business. I was scared that my house would be set on fire like our mayor's was. I was scared that my house would be vandalized like people on city council multiple times. And I was afraid for my kids. I was afraid for my family. And the more I talked to people and the more people that started listening to the podcast, the more confident I became that we can change things. I mean, I was talking to people who also consider themselves progressive. They can say, I no longer call myself a progressive, but I talk to people who consider themselves progressive, and they're aligned with us on the idea that this is not a housing issue. One of them is Renee Gonzalez, who just won. I'm going to go to a swearing in tonight. He just won city councilor. So my tagline for the podcast used to be everything you can't say in Portland. And the idea was we're going to have all these discussions online that we're going to upload that we can only have in these closed rooms under pseudonyms. I was under a pseudonym. Many people came on under their own name, but I was under a pseudonym. And I just started, I came out under my own name. I dropped the tagline. And then at the start of 2023, we were named by Coin News, which is a mainstream news organization. My podcast was named as the number one podcast to listen to in 2023.
Awesome.
So we are changing. We're definitely changing the narrative by having these conversations. I, to the extent Rational in Portland podcast has played any role in that, I'm thrilled. But, you know, I've got politicians who are by any measure totally progressive coming on, speaking into a microphone, talking about how this is a drug crisis that we are not going to build our way out of, and that we have got to engage in some different kind of modality to get these people off the street. So I have some hope, Brandy. The conversations are changing. Did we elect Tina Kotek? Yes. But we also elected Renee Gonzalez. And in doing that, we voted out the woman who defunded our police to the tune of $27 million. Her name was Joanne Hardesty. Is Joanne Hardesty. She's no longer in city council. And that would have been unthinkable in 2020. I mean, we were in lock. This city was in lockstep with her in 2020. And she did everything she wanted. And in fact, we're going to be living with some of those policies for a long time, unfortunately. Long term, I think it can happen. I think it's going to be incremental. It's going to take time and patience. But Rational in Portland is now mainstream. We're no longer having these conversations in hushed tones with pseudonyms. People want to come on and they want to talk about these issues candidly. And to the extent we're still at some ideological impasse, I think that can be overcome with data. And that's part of this coalition that Michael Schellenberger started that I'm part of. One of the goals is to try to bring to light all of this data that we have that show it's not a housing crisis.
Yeah. Well, bless you for doing this. And what was your pseudonym?
Karen, because I'm a white lady.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
You know what, Brandy? What really helped me shed that is when Renee Gonzalez, who's now on city council, came on. At one point he said, now I'm supposed to call you Karen, right? And of course he's sallying forth into this hellhole under his own name. And I felt ashamed. Wow. I felt sick to my stomach and I felt ashamed of myself. Mm. And he was nice enough to kind of bear with me through that process and transformation. But I realized that if he is willing to do this and for the good of our city and put himself under fire and in the line of fire, and I realize more good people need to speak out. You know, yeah. More people like you, Brandy. We need more shows like yours. We've got to fill this vacuum of discussions, and we need to talk to each other. And good people need to speak out and talk about these issues and talk about the real data.
It's what I've been preaching to folks. You know, I think the middle is sometimes scared, the common sense, rational middle, scared to say something for the reasons that you articulated. They're scared to be attacked. They're scared to be vilified. They're scared people will come after their employer. And at some point you have to decide, is it worth it or is it not worth it? And you decided that it's worth it. Did any of your fears come true about what would happen
to
you?
No. In fact, we've gained business. And some of my clients, even when I was under a pseudonym, would say things like, I know that you're doing this and God bless you for doing it. And these were people that I thought would think I was the devil and would just drop me like a hot coal. And that hasn't happened. I think they're just, people are curious. They actually are intellectually curious. They just don't have the time or the money to sit down and dig into this kind of stuff. And I'm sure you found that too, Brandy. Yeah. I mean, look at this huge vacuum that you filled. Look at your followers on social media. Look at the people that are turning to you for their news. They're not tuning in to Como. They're tuning in to you and Jonathan Cho.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want people to be able to listen to your podcast as well, because it, like you said, I mean, people need to, I think we need business owners who are willing to stick their neck out. We need regular folks, voters of all political stripes who are willing to say what they're thinking. So how can people, Kristen, listen to the podcast if they're so inclined?
Well, we're everywhere. It's on Spotify. It's on iTunes. Everywhere you find your, I've got girlfriends who have an app called Overcast that I never heard of, and that's where they listen to it. So it's anywhere you find your podcast. It's called Rational in Portland. And we just engage in long form conversations with people, not just in Portland. For instance, I've talked to Jonathan Cho. I talked to Tom Wolf, who's in San Francisco, who's he used to be homeless. He's a recovering addict that lived in the Tenderloin. And he's part of this coalition with Michael Schellenberger, with that I'm working with to end homelessness and drug addiction. He was on. So I talked to people in other cities who have similar issues or are suffering for the similar kinds of things. And I agree with you, Brandy. More of us have got to start talking, or else this narrative will never change. If we're all terrified and we're living in our silos and quaking in our boots, then we're never going to be able to change the narrative, and our cities will continue to decay and decline. And we can't have that for our kids. We can't have that for ourselves. We can't live like that. And more importantly, these people splayed out on the streets and the gutters, they shouldn't live like that. This is deplorable. These are disgusting conditions that nobody should live in.
Yeah. Damn. Kristen Olson, good stuff. Thank you for coming on. I'm going to be harassing you for Portland issues, and I'm going to be like, come back on. So awesome stuff.
Please do, anytime.
Yeah. Thanks for the work you're doing, and thanks for being willing to speak out.
Thanks for having me, Brandy.
It's Friday. That means it's time to check in on what's happening in the Sunshine State. It's our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Joining us is my sister Miranda, who has some new, you've got a new bang look going on.
Yeah, it's a work in progress. My rabbits are stylists by day now, apparently.
So I saw that and I was like, what happened? Your rabbits chewed off some of your hair.
Yes, not for nothing. My hair is not real blonde, so it does get a little dry, so it might double as hay to them. So when I lay with them on the floor in the morning and just hang out, they chewed off a really big chunk of my hair. So now I have to figure out what to do with it.
So you just kind of, you evened it out on the other side?
I tried, but I'm not a stylist, so I need some help. I'm going to have to go see a stylist over the weekend to get it fixed.
That's all right. You're still pretty.
Thanks.
Okay, Ron DeSantis and Florida, you guys are dealing with an immigration situation. We talked about it last week, Cuban migrants. I know there's been some push and pull between the White House, the feds, the state of Florida, but the Coast Guard is now seeking a little bit of aid for the migrants who are rushing into Key West.
Yeah, and this comes, they sent an email asking for help just a few hours after the Biden administration had kind of drugged DeSantis for, you know, calling his ask for the Florida National Guard to be deployed being a political stunt. And then within just a few hours, he gets an email from the Coast Guard like, please help us. Please send airplanes to help us patrol the borders. So yeah, they sent an email literally asking for very specific types of aircrafts to patrol above, you know, just to get a better vantage point so they can maybe get on top of some of these immigrants before they actually reach the shorelines. Because these last couple of weeks have been a pretty huge influx of immigrants coming from not just Cuba, but there's some Haitian immigrants landing and Dominican and people from all over the island. So hopefully the Biden administration and the DeSantis administration can find a way to work together on this, because it's not a political stunt. Like, it's physically happening. There's videos, there's footage of it. There's boats being left on people's properties. It's very real. It's not a stunt. Something needs to happen.
Yeah, and it's dangerous for the migrants as well, as you pointed out last week. This is a really treacherous journey. And that's what's bothersome is, you know, especially at this border crisis and the immigration crisis, it highlights the dysfunction of the two-party system, because it's more about bickering than it is about problem solving. And this is a perfect example of that. I want to talk to you about the environment quick, because our governor thinks he is the climate governor. That is his thing. But, you know, I think that there's actually Ron DeSantis has been given a lot of credit for his care about environmental issues, and that's going to continue into his second term.
Yeah, it is. And you know me, I really do love nature. And I think that it's just one of the things that makes life just a beautiful place to be sometimes is going outside and seeing clean streets and, you know, whatever. So one of the things DeSantis did when he was first inaugurated his first term was sign this climate pledge that basically put a lot of attention to the health of Florida's waterways, preventing blue and red algae blooms, which just destroy the quality of life for not only the marine inhabitants, but also people. You can't even go near the water when the blooms are happening. It smells so bad. In addition to that, the pledge also puts a lot of money towards just like restoring the Everglades. Everglades is a living, breathing ecosystem that it is extremely important, the health of the Everglades for the rest of Florida. So DeSantis puts a lot of attention on that. And whether he is just a nature nut or he really understands that people come to Florida to enjoy the nature we have here and that tourism is a really big part of our economy down here, I think that he puts a lot of attention towards the environment. So he re-signed the same pledge that he did 4 years ago and just put a little bit more enthusiasm behind it just to let people know that this is something that he's going to continue to do. And he thinks that we should leave Florida to God better than we found it. And I can't help but to agree.
Well, and I kind of like that what he's focusing on are these very tangible issues, you know, that impact tourism, that impact industry, that impact livelihoods. And I'm not saying I don't think climate change is real, but I think when you get into progressives who are like, oh, emissions and climate and the earth heating, that's much different than saying, hey, we've got these algae blooms, we need to deal with them. And then you see either they continue to be a problem or they don't. And so it's a very tangible, so it is a very kind of Republican way of looking at the environment and something that's a little more like tangible and cut and dry, if that makes sense.
No, it really does. Because, you know, when you talk about, like you said, the earth heating up and global warming, it's such like this grandiose thought that it's hard to even find anything relatable towards it. So it's easy to just look the other way and keep moving. But whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent, you go to the beach and there's algae in the water, your day is ruined. And this is a very relatable thing for Floridians. It's a problem that's happened for years. And I've actually seen it kind of, we didn't have any really bad red tide blooms the last couple of years. So I wonder if some of this money that he puts towards this climate pledge, which is well over $3 billion, has helped with that. But more power to him. It definitely, he gets my support on that, because that's, like you said, it's just a very tangible thing that we're going to see solutions for.
Yeah, you are nothing if not a hippie. So if you are supportive of his environmental efforts, I have to believe that they're working. But yeah, this is just a really interesting conversation, because also, you know, on the reducing emissions front, for instance, an individual state can commit itself to that, but it doesn't make even a fraction of a difference globally when you've got these polluters like India and China. And so you're trying to make a difference in something that is like a tiny little needle in a sea of hay. And then again, you go to something more tangible in Florida, where you're saying, hey, here's something we can make a real difference on right now, visually speaking. Let's see. Let's fit one more thing in. This is sad. We love our whales in Washington State. It's just such a majestic thing to be able to look out. I've been fishing out in CQ, which is this little fishing village out on the coast in Washington. And I've seen whales fishing, and it's like, oh my God, I can't believe there's a creature like that on the planet. You guys had an unusual situation for Florida wash up on the beaches down there, and it did die.
Yeah, it beached itself. I guess whales normally do this when they're feeling sick or something's wrong with them, but a 21-foot killer whale has died after it beached itself in a northern beach here in Florida. And some of the representatives for NOAA were talking about how it's not uncommon to find these whales in warmer waters, but this is the first time that there's ever been a report of a beaching of an orca in the southeastern United States. So they're going to perform a necropsy. Yeah. To see if there was anything wrong. Perhaps it was, you know, sick or had a disease or something, and see why it happened to die on our beaches down here. But it is really sad. And when I read that story, I was like, well, this might actually touch home for the Pacific Northwesterners, because you guys do have a huge whaling community out there of people who love to enjoy watching them and
do
their thing.
Not whaling. Isn't whaling the murder of whales?
Well, when you watch birds, it's called birding. So
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think whaling is like when you murder whales.
We have whale a lot of watching community.
Yes, we have whale lovers. So just so we are clear. All right, Miranda, have a great weekend. Good luck with your bangs, okay?
Thanks. We'll check back in on those next week.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
We are coming to the end of the road, or at least today's podcast, I guess. Let's end with viewer comments per the usual. We had on the show this week Chad Magandans, who is a former Washington state representative, who says, look, we got to do something about these lying candidates. There's limitations to how much you can prevent lying from reaching the eyes and ears of voters. But one of the things that he's proposing, and he proposed it in a Seattle Times op-ed, was let's make it a requirement that the voter guide be fact-checked just for the basics, for education, work history, military service. Because when the voter guide is sent out to Washingtonians with their ballots, a lot of people don't know that nobody fact checks that. The only thing that's done, or the only limit, is the number of words. So like I could say I'm a 25-time Olympic gold medalist and a former Miss Universe, and nobody fact checks that. I mean, it's contingent on the press and the voters, but can we rely on the press to do that? And certainly the voters. I mean, come on. Are you going to go through every candidate in your ballot and call up their universities and be like, hey, could I get the transcripts for this person? No, it's just ridiculous. So you guys were kind of torn on this. And I'm a little torn on it as well. I'll talk about more of that in a second. But let me read some of your comments. Eric said, if there were more journalists and networks who did their jobs while being government watchdogs instead of doing the bidding of politicians, I think it would go a long way. And that's true. But, you know, even in the case of Clyde Shavers, the newly sworn in Washington state representative who lied about being an attorney and inflated his military service, he got the endorsement of the Everett Herald, which is the biggest newspaper in that district. And they only found out later on, like, really too late, that what he told them was a lie and they rescinded it. But so I don't know that you can always, that we have a robust enough media environment anymore to catch some of these things. Jack wrote, wait, didn't we just exit a pandemic where the state proved a massive failure on relaying facts? Please provide examples of any state agency that consistently provides facts and does not spend more time spinning a narrative. And that is, I think, one of my fundamental challenges with it. Who's going to do the fact-checking? Are we going to be able to account for the personal bias as part of their fact-checking? And how do you gauge, like, whether something is inflated or, you know, an outright lie? I think, you know, one of the things that Chad Magandans said about that, because I did ask him about that during our interview, is he said you'd only be fact-checking the obvious black and white yes or no. Did you go to college at the University of Washington and graduate? Did you serve in the military and were honorably discharged, et cetera? So I think it would have to be very, very narrow in scope, and you couldn't get the government involved in, you know, fact-checking a lot of individual claims that are more murky, if that makes sense. Lynette thinks this is a good idea. She wrote, yes and yes, we have the FTC, which scrutinizes company advertising to ensure they do it in a way that doesn't mislead or lie to consumers. Why don't we have the same clearinghouse for all politicians? A couple more. Tim said, oh, hell no. Could there be a bigger conflict of interest than letting the state create a ministry of truth? You know, that's a good point. This is the job of the press, LOL, he says in parentheses, and individual citizens. And we'll give Kristen the last word. It would be great if fact-checking happened on both sides, but we've all experienced and seen who gets hit by fact-checkers. That's true. So I'm kind of torn on this. I think it would have to be very limited in scope. But to me, you know, sending out voter guides that you're not fact-checking, I don't know what's productive in that as well. And I'm not saying, I mean, the vast majority of people don't tell these dramatic lies about their history,
but we've seen that some do and some still get away with it. All right, that's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. I'll have the newsletter on Sunday, and then we'll be back with a new episode on Monday. If you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, remember we do 3 episodes a week. The Wednesday episode is just for subscribers, and we always have a lot of fun without you non-subscribers, so you've got to see what you're missing out on. You can subscribe in 2 ways to help support the show. Patreon.com/undivided. That's patreon.com/undivided. Or you can become a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com.